thank you very much, David, for that really wonderful, undeserved introduction. It certainly is a special pleasure for me to be here and to have the opportunity to spend at least a little bit of time enjoying some of what the KITP has been doing so wonderfully successfully. Special thanks are due to these people for crucial support in preparing this talk. I'm sure that you all know that we human beings and all the objects that we encounter in our everyday lives are all made of three kinds of very tiny particles. Yeah, I found
this.
Well, this one is going to fail in about 10 minutes when it makes an atomic transition to a state that doesn't lase. Anyway, this laser and we human beings and everything that we encounter in our everyday lives are made of three kinds of very tiny particles: electrons, protons, and neutrons. And as you know, these particles are bound together to make atoms. The neutrons and the protons form the nucleus of each atom, and then the electrons are on the outside. And the atoms, in turn, are the building blocks of us, of buildings, and of our home planet. And so it is natural for us to assume that electrons, protons, and neutrons are the building blocks of the whole universe. But that assumption would be completely wrong. Actually, electrons, protons, and neutrons are rarities in the universe. For every one of them, the universe as a whole contains a billion neutrinos, usually denoted by this Greek letter nu. Indeed, the neutrinos are among the most abundant particles in the universe. So to understand the universe, we have to understand the neutrinos. Within each cubic foot of space, you know, like this, there are about 10 million neutrinos that were made in the Big Bang that created the universe. And as a result of that, within each person in this room, there are some 30 million neutrinos that were made in the Big Bang. In addition, passing through each person in this room every second are some 100 trillion neutrinos that are made in the sun. The sun shines because of nuclear reactions that take place in its center. These reactions produce the energy of the sun, which energy makes possible our life here on Earth. And they also produce neutrinos. And they also produce all the, well, not all, but many of the important atoms that are more complicated than the simplest atom, the hydrogen atom, which contains just one proton in the nucleus with one electron. Since all these more complicated atoms, which are ingredients of us, are made in stars, we humans are quite literally made of stardust. Now, those neutrinos that are made by these nuclear processes in the sun come zipping out in all directions, and some of them are coming our way. And some 100 trillion of them, as I said, zip through each person on Earth every second. So neutrinos, lots of them, are quite literally getting under your skin. Should we be worried about that? I mean, you know, what about medical problems induced by neutrinos? Well, no, you don't have to worry, because neutrinos interact with other stuff like us very, very feebly. In fact, to a neutrino, each of us looks as if we weren't there. To us, a person looks very solid. But to a neutrino, the person looks invisible. The neutrino just zips right through the person as if the person weren't there. In fact, the neutrino from the sun would have to zip through 10 gazillion people stacked one behind the other before it would do anything at all. So the probability that a particular solar neutrino interacts in a particular one of us is 1 over 10 gazillion. So you don't have to worry about it. However, if you're a scientist trying to study neutrinos, this is a problem. The same feebleness of interaction makes the neutrinos very hard to pin down and study. They are ghost-like. They are abundant, all right, but elusive. Are neutrinos important to our lives? Do they make any difference? Well, yes, I would say so, because if there were no neutrinos, the sun and the stars would not shine. The nuclear reactions that make them shine could not take place. So there would be no energy from the sun to keep us warm. There would be no atoms more complicated than the hydrogen atom. No carbon, which is one of our major ingredients. No oxygen, a major ingredient of water. So no water, no earth, no moon, no us. So no news would be very bad news. So what are neutrinos? Neutrino is a word that means a little neutral Italian object. How little? Very little. The size of a neutrino is approximately 1/1000th the size of an atomic nucleus. How much do neutrinos weigh? Very little. In fact, years of experiments yielded no evidence that neutrinos weigh anything at all. What? Can a particle weigh absolutely nothing? Can you have a thing which is there so you can call it a particle and yet it doesn't weigh anything? Well, yes. A particle can be a bundle of pure energy without any mass at all. In fact, the photon, which is the particle of which a light beam is made, is like that. It is just a bundle of energy. But we have recently discovered that neutrinos are not like that. Neutrinos, to be sure, weigh much less than the electrons, the protons, or the neutrons, but they do have non-zero masses. How do we know that? We'll come to that. Are all neutrinos the same, or are there different varieties of neutrinos? Yes, there are different varieties. Neutrinos come in three different types, or flavors as they are called. The electron neutrino, nu sub e for electron, the muon neutrino, nu sub mu, the Greek mu for muon, and the tau neutrino, a Greek tau for tau. I would have given these flavors different names, but they didn't ask me. The first two of these were discovered, the nu e and the nu mu, were discovered decades ago. But the last, the nu tau, was discovered only quite recently, within the last few years, at Fermilab. How do these three flavors of neutrinos differ from one another? Well, all the particles of a given kind, like the electrons, are absolutely identical to one another. An electron does not come with birthmarks so that you can tell one electron from another one because it's got a pimple here. Electrons, instead, are all absolutely identical to each other. However, there are three kinds or flavors of electron-like particles. The electron itself, the muon, which is some 200 times heavier than the electron, and the tau, which is some 3,500 times heavier than the electron. Now, associated with each of these electron-like particles is a neutrino. The nu e is associated with the electron, the nu mu with the muon, and the nu tau with the tau. And I'll explain in just a second what that association means. The electron, muon, and the tau, these electron-like particles, are all electrically charged, and they are known as the charged leptons. Now, what does the association mean? Neutrinos are created in a variety of physical processes, and when a neutrino is born, it is born together with a charged lepton. And the neutrino and the charged lepton always have the same flavor. So, you can have a neutrino born together with an electron, and then it will be the nu e. Or, if it is born together with a muon, it will be the nu mu. If it is born together with a tau, it will be the nu tau. A nu mu is not born together with a tau. The charged lepton and the neutrino that are produced together are always of the same flavor as each other. In addition, when a neutrino collides with an atom in a neutrino detector, typically it creates another charged lepton. And the charged lepton that it creates will be of the same flavor as the neutrino. So when an electron neutrino interacts in a detector and makes a charged lepton, that charged lepton will have the same flavor as this neutrino, that is, it will be an electron. Similarly, if a nu mu interacts, the charged lepton will be a muon, And if a new tau interacts, the charged lepton will be a tau. A new mu does not make an electron or a tau. Always a muon. So the birth, the lives and times, and the death of a neutrino can be summarized like this. The neutrino is born in association with a charged lepton, and if that charged lepton is an electron, the neutrino will be an electron neutrino. And then when that neutrino interacts in a detector to make another charged lepton, that charged lepton will again be an electron, the same as the original charged lepton. If instead the original charged lepton is a muon, this will be a muon neutrino, and then when it makes a particle in a detector, that will be another muon. Flavors do not mix. A new mu does not make a tau. Now, it's been known for a long, long time that if neutrinos have any masses at all, then those masses are very tiny compared to those of the other particles. So the challenge was how to detect very, very small masses. How do you do that? Well, suppose neutrinos have non-zero masses. Then, if you give a neutrino enough time to change its character, then it can do an amazing thing. It can morph from one flavor to another. So, for instance, you can have a neutrino that is born together with a muon, hence it is a muon neutrino, and then you let it go on some long journey during the course of which it has time to evolve, and then you detect it in a detector, and when you do that, it can happen that the charged lepton is not another muon, but, for example, a tau. So, in the course of making this long journey, this neutrino has turned from a muon neutrino into a tau neutrino. In fact, the neutrino can do something even more amazing than that. It oscillates back and forth between different flavors. So it can be born as a muon neutrino, like here, and then later, after it has had some time to evolve, it's maybe a muon neutrino and maybe a tau neutrino. And then still later, it is purely a tau neutrino, and if it interacts at this point, it will certainly make a tau. And then still later, it is again maybe a muon neutrino and maybe a tau neutrino, which means if it interacts at this point, maybe it will make a muon and maybe it will make a tau. And then later still, it is purely the original flavor again, which means if it interacts at this point in time, it will certainly make a muon and then back and forth. Except for the neutrinos from the Big Bang, neutrinos zip along at very high speeds, essentially the speed of light. And so, giving a neutrino time to change its flavor means allowing it to travel a long distance during the time of which it will change its flavor. So, when we give neutrinos time to morph, what that means is we have to let them travel a distance. To summarize pictorially this oscillation between flavors, imagine that a neutrino is born as a muon neutrino. Then as time goes on, it gradually becomes more and more a tau neutrino until it is totally a tau neutrino. And then later it's maybe a new mu and maybe a new tau. And then later it's a new mu again. And then maybe later it's maybe one and maybe the other. And later it is purely a new tau. And later it is again maybe one and maybe the other. And then later still, it is purely the original flavor, and this goes on and on. It just keeps oscillating back and forth. We'll come to that. Now, you may be very puzzled, how is it that a neutrino can be maybe a this and maybe a that? That has to do with quantum mechanics, which governs the world of the very small particles. As was emphasized in the recent play by Michael Frayn, Copenhagen, quantum mechanics and other aspects of life, too, involves uncertainty at its core. So an object in quantum mechanics can perhaps be here and perhaps there. It can perhaps be a this and perhaps a that. It can perhaps be a new mu and perhaps a new tau. And our neutrino is taking advantage of that. It starts out as purely one, but later it's maybe that one, but maybe something else. And later it's totally this. And later it is again maybe this and maybe that, and back and forth. Now, the particles of which we are made cannot do that. A proton is a proton, and 10 to the umpity-ump years from now, it is still a proton. It does not morph into something else. So how is it that a muon neutrino morphs into a tau neutrino? Well, the answer is that a muon neutrino is actually not a particle to begin with. There are neutrino particles. They are unimaginatively called the first one, the second one, and the third one, in order of increasing mass. And these particles we've been, these objects we've been talking about, the electron neutrino, the muon neutrino, and the tau neutrino, are not particles, but each of them is actually a mixture of the neutrino particles nu1, nu2, and nu3. It is these particles which are like a proton. Each of them has a definite mass. And when a neutrino is born in association with a charged lepton, a nu e with an e, a nu mu with a mu, and so forth, the emitted neutrino is actually maybe a nu1, maybe a nu2, and maybe a nu3. So for example, the thing we've been calling the electron neutrino is actually not a particle. But, as is the nature of quantum mechanics, maybe it's this particle, maybe it's that one, and maybe it's that one. You can think of a neutrino of definite flavor, the thing that's born together with a charged lepton, as a soup made of these three ingredients. And the electron, muon, and tau neutrinos are different soups, all made from these same ingredients, nu1, 2, and 3. Consequently, the voyage of a neutrino looks like this. Suppose, for instance, it's born together with a muon. So it is a muon neutrino. That's a certain particular soup of nu1, nu2, and nu3. Then this soup bowl travels, and because nu1, nu2, and nu3 have different masses from each other, they will travel at different speeds. And so later on, they have become separated from one another at any given one point in the traveling soup bowl. And if you look at what is in that point at inside the soup bowl, it's a different mixture of nu1, nu2, and nu3 than you had at the beginning, which is to say that this neutrino is not the same as the original neutrino. It's something else, and it could, for example, be a tau neutrino, so that when it interacts in the detector, it makes a tau rather than a mu. This is possible. That is, the original soup can turn into a different soup only because these pieces of the soup travel at different speeds. And that they do because they have different masses. So for this morphing of flavor to take place implies that these particles have non-zero masses. Otherwise, the masses couldn't be different from each other. So neutrino flavor change implies neutrino mass. Indeed, neutrino flavor change, or neutrino oscillation as it is sometimes called because the flavor oscillates back and forth between the original one and a new one, can make even very tiny neutrino masses visible if you just let the neutrinos travel for a great enough distance that they have enough time for the character of the soup to change. Now, it's only within the last 5 years that we have discovered experimentally compelling evidence that neutrinos actually do change flavor in nature, so they must have non-zero masses. Let me give you some examples of that evidence. The nuclear processes which power the sun create neutrinos together with electrons. So what they create are electron neutrinos, not muon or tau neutrinos, just electron neutrinos. Paradoxically, to detect the neutrinos that are made in the sun and arrive here on Earth, we have to go deep underground. The reason is that there is a steady rain of protons and heavier particles striking the Earth's atmosphere from outer space. And because these particles come from outer space, they are called cosmic rays. And a cosmic ray can rather easily strike an atom in a neutrino detector and make that detector light up in just the same way it would as if a neutrino were to strike an atom, so the cosmic ray can mimic a neutrino. So you do an experiment, you think you're detecting neutrinos, but you're actually detecting cosmic rays. This is, of course, a problem. And to eliminate these cosmic ray imposters, we put the detector deep underground where the cosmic rays cannot penetrate, but the neutrinos, because of their feebleness of their interaction, get down there without any trouble. Now, you could imagine just digging a very deep hole in the ground, but it is much easier to use a hole which somebody has already dug for you. So here we are, 6,800 feet below Sudbury, Canada, in the Creighton Nickel Mine, which is a functioning nickel mine. And this is the site of the Sudbury Neutrino Observatory, referred to as SNOW, in honor of what's above the mine. The SNOW detector is essentially a sphere, and here is a person to indicate the size of this sphere, and it is filled with a variety of water, so-called heavy water. Now, the SNOW detector detects neutrinos coming from the sun and colliding with atoms in the heavy water in several different ways. One way detects only electron neutrinos coming from the sun, so it counts the number of electron neutrinos coming from the sun per day. Another method of detection counts all the neutrinos coming from the sun, regardless of their flavor. And by comparing these two counts, SNOW finds that the number of electron neutrinos coming from the sun is only a third the total number coming from the sun. What that means is that two-thirds of the neutrinos coming from the sun are these muon and tau neutrinos. Again, the sun makes only electron neutrinos. No new mus or new taus. But because electron neutrinos arriving here from the sun are only a third of the total, two-thirds of the total must be muon or tau neutrinos, even though the sun doesn't make any. So the conclusion is that two-thirds of the solar neutrinos have morphed into muon and tau neutrinos before reaching the Earth. Neutrinos do change flavor. And therefore, because of this discussion of the soup, they have non-zero masses. Detailed studies of the solar neutrinos tell us that this change of flavor has already taken place by the time the neutrinos emerge from the sun. Despite the feebleness with which neutrinos interact with stuff, they have a kind of an interaction with solar material on the way out of the sun. It's like the interaction of light with very clear glass. Now, of course, that doesn't stop the light, nor does it stop the neutrinos, but it does affect the light. For example, you can make a lens out of clear glass and it will bend the direction in which the light is going. And similarly, it has an effect on the neutrinos. That effect is to somewhat increase the number of neutrinos that change flavor. Now, suppose that you are doing an experiment in which your detector can only detect neutrinos of, let's say, vanilla flavor. If vanilla neutrinos change flavor on their way to your detector, you will think the neutrinos have just disappeared because you can see only vanilla neutrinos. So if we have, let's say, the sun making vanilla neutrinos and then they change into chocolate before they get here and you can only see vanilla neutrinos, you're going to think that those neutrinos, which actually became chocolate, just disappear. The original solar neutrino experiment, which was performed by Ray Davis and his co-workers, could detect only electron neutrinos. These are neutrinos of the flavor made in the sun. That experiment saw only one-third of the neutrinos that were predicted. And so for many years, people thought, yeah, this experiment must be wrong. Or maybe the theory that makes the prediction is wrong. Or maybe they're both wrong. But in fact, we now know that neither of them is wrong. What has happened is that two-thirds of the neutrinos, born as nu e, have morphed on their way here into muon or tau neutrinos, which are invisible in this original solar neutrino experiment. So of course, the experiment should only see a third of the predicted number. The predicted number didn't know that neutrinos change flavor. And in fact, two-thirds of them do change flavor, becoming invisible to this experiment. So the experiment sees only a third what had been the prediction. And last fall, a Nobel Prize was awarded to Ray Davis for his work with the solar neutrinos. That's one example of the neutrino disappearing act. A second example, nuclear power reactors produce electron neutrinos. Actually, it's electron antineutrinos indicated by this bar, but the bar is not important for our purposes. Never mind the bar for the moment. Electron neutrinos. Now, detectors of what's coming out of reactors cannot see muon or tau neutrinos. They can only see electron neutrinos. The observed changing of flavor of the solar neutrinos implies that many of these electron neutrinos coming out of reactors should disappear into neutrinos of the other flavors by the time they have traveled something like 100 miles. In a zinc mine in Kamioka in Japan, located about 110 miles from some big reactors in the Japanese power grid, the normal power grid, is the Camland reactor electron neutrino detector. And Camland finds that some 40% of the electron neutrinos emitted by the reactors have indeed disappeared by the time they reach the detector. Another example of the neutrino disappearing act. I always encourage people who have colds to take zinc lozenges. I don't know if they do anything for your cold, but they do support neutrino physics. A third example, these pesky cosmic rays that we put the detectors underground to get away from, colliding with atoms in the air, make, among other things, muon neutrinos. And it's observed that half these atmospheric muon neutrinos disappear while they transit the Earth. So, for example, there is a detector placed in this same Kamioka zinc mine by Masatoshi Koshiba. It is put there for a variety of purposes, but one of the things it does is to detect these neutrinos made in the atmosphere by cosmic rays. Now, if a neutrino is made on the far side of the Earth by cosmic rays and then transits the Earth to reach the detector, it will be coming up to the detector from underneath, so we know that's one of the neutrinos that came from the far side of the Earth. On the other hand, if it is made in the atmosphere above the detector, it will be coming into the detector from above, so when that happens, we'll know this is a neutrino that was made just overhead. These neutrinos travel only a short distance. These travel the diameter of the Earth. These have much more time than those to morph into another flavor, and what's found is that the number of neutrinos coming up from below, in other words, coming from the far side of the Earth, is only half the number of neutrinos coming down from above, in other words, coming from just overhead. While the neutrinos travel the Earth, in other words, half of them disappear. Yet another disappearing act. And last fall, Mr. Koshiba shared in the Nobel Prize with Ray Davis for his work with underground detectors. And all of these neutrino disappearing acts that we've been talking about are beautifully described in detail as changes of flavor. The neutrinos aren't actually disappearing altogether. They're simply turning from a flavor which the detector can see into a flavor which the detector cannot see. So they become invisible. Now, what would we like to know about the neutrinos in addition to the fact that we have discovered they have masses? One question. Do neutrinos come in flavors other than vanilla, chocolate, and strawberry? There is an experiment in Los Alamos using man-made neutrinos that suggests the answer to this question is yes. But that would be a big surprise, since we only know of three electron-like particles, the electron, the muon, and the tau. So why shouldn't there be just the three associated neutrinos, the new E, the new mu, and the new tau? This experiment suggests that there are additional neutrinos. But because that would be such a big surprise, there is an experiment currently in progress at Fermilab targeted at either confirming this experiment or refuting it. Second question, how much do the neutrino particles, the ones with definite masses, nu1, nu2, and nu3, weigh? The neutrino oscillation data tell us that the heaviest of them, the one we call nu3, weighs more than 1/10,000th as much as an electron, Well, that's not very heavy. One ten millionth. The number is correct. What I said is not. The lumpiness of the universe, that is, the fact that there are clusters of galaxies and voids in between, appears to be telling us that, on the other hand, this heaviest neutrino, this same neutrino, weighs no more than 5 × 10^1000000th the mass of an electron. So we have pinned the mass of the heaviest neutrino down to between 1/10 millionth and 5 × 10^1000000ths of the mass of the electron. That is to say, this neutrino is very, very light compared to other particles that we know about. Now, you may wonder what the lumpiness of the universe has to do with how much a neutrino weighs. That is an illustration that, yes, indeed, the neutrinos are very abundant in the universe, and they do play a role in shaping the universe that we see. And from what they have done in the universe and what they have not done in the universe, we can draw conclusions about how much the neutrinos weigh through our observations of the universe. And that is where that mass information came from. But we saw that the neutrinos, at the most, weigh very, very little. How come they weigh so much less than the other particles? To make a long story short, we don't know. But knowing the answer to this question might shed light on the origin of all the particle masses. Where do the particles get their masses? Why does the electron weigh what it weighs? We don't really understand that. At this point, there is only speculation about why the neutrinos are so light. But there are some very interesting speculations. Are the neutrinos the reason that the universe contains matter but almost no antimatter? What do I mean by this question? For every particle, there is a corresponding antiparticle. So corresponding to the electron, there is the positron, to the proton, the antiproton, to the neutron, the antineutron, and to the neutrino, the antineutrino. These particles are called the particles of matter, and these are called the particles of antimatter. Now, if a blob made of matter, one of us, for example, encounters a blob made of antimatter, the particles of matter and the particles of antimatter annihilate one another. And as you see, everything disappears. So it is a very good thing that the universe contains matter, of which we are made, but essentially no antimatter. So we don't have to worry about walking into a cloud of antimatter and going poof. Now, symmetry considerations suggest, just normal considerations of symmetry, that in the Big Bang that started the universe, there were equal amounts of matter and antimatter. And that the present asymmetry, the fact that we have matter but no antimatter, developed later. For that to have happened, matter and antimatter must behave differently. And the reason is sort of obvious. If you start with equal amounts of matter and antimatter, and they behave in the same way, then of course you're going to continue to have equal amounts of matter and antimatter. In order to get a lopsided universe in which you have a lot of matter and no antimatter, the matter and the antimatter have to behave differently. Otherwise, you can't get this asymmetry. Now, we have already seen in laboratory experiments that there is indeed a difference not involving neutrinos between the behavior of matter and antimatter, but that difference is way too small to explain the universe, to explain the fact that there's matter in the universe but essentially no antimatter. On the other hand, if neutrinos should prove to behave differently from antineutrinos, the physics of the neutrinos and the antineutrinos might lead to an explanation of our matter-antimatter lopsided universe containing matter but no antimatter. And so one of the very important questions which people hope to answer through future studies of neutrinos is there a difference between the behavior of neutrinos and antineutrinos? If there is, that difference might have something very deep to do with the fact that the universe contains matter and essentially no antimatter making our existence safe. So to sum up, neutrinos are a billion times more abundant than the particles of which we are made, but they are elusive. They have very, very tiny but non-zero masses. We know that from their flavor changes. They can do amazing things, including this morphing from chocolate to strawberry flavor and oscillating back and forth between the two. Without the neutrinos, the sun wouldn't shine, and we wouldn't be here talking about the neutrinos. And because the sun shines, it produces lots and lots of neutrinos. And those neutrinos are there, under our skin, always. Thank you.
Was a spectacularly clear talk, and Boris kindly left a lot of time, and as you can see, such an incredible pedagogue that I hope there are a lot of good questions. So let's start here.
I noticed that two-thirds of the solar neutrinos changed flavors, but only half of the cosmic ray neutrinos.
And the question is why? The detailed mechanisms through which these two neutrinos change flavor are a little bit different. The cosmic ray neutrinos, the ones that are made in the atmosphere, would do the same thing that they do in transiting the Earth, even if the Earth were not there. This is, a change of flavor in vacuum. The interaction with Earth matter is not important. On the other hand, the interaction of the solar neutrinos with solar material on their way out of the sun is important. And were there not that interaction with solar neutrinos, then the fraction of the solar neutrinos that change flavor also would be a half or less. It wouldn't be two-thirds. The thing that makes the difference is the interaction with the material. And of course, there is a lot more solar material encountered by the solar neutrinos than there is Earth material. They're traveling a much greater distance through matter, and the matter is also denser.
How do we get neutrinos?
How do we manufacture them?
Where do they? You're talking about what happens to them, but where do they come from?
Okay, I will take that to be a two-part question. How does nature make neutrinos, and how do we make them? Let us talk about the solar neutrinos first. They are made by nature. The solar neutrinos are made in fusion reactions. One of them is two protons coming together. These make what is called a deuteron, plus two other particles, a positron and a neutrino. And the proton is a particle which is spinning like a little top. The deuteron is also spinning like a little top, but it has twice as much spin as the proton. And spin is one of those things which is conserved, as they say. You have to have as much spin at the end as you did at the beginning. If we made only the deuteron and the positron, the spins wouldn't add up. We would have violated conservation of spin. It is for that the neutrino is necessary. If the neutrino weren't made in that reaction, spin would not be conserved, the reaction couldn't take place in the first place, no fusion, no sunshine, no us. So that's one of the ways in which they are made. In the case of cosmic rays making the neutrinos in the Earth's atmosphere, in comes a cosmic ray, it collides with a nitrogen nucleus, it makes garbage, you should excuse me. The garbage includes little particles that are called pi mesons. And when the pi mesons decay, they disintegrate, they don't live very long. Each pi meson makes a muon and a muon neutrino. If it made only a muon, energy wouldn't be conserved and spin wouldn't be conserved. The neutrino is necessary. How do we make neutrinos? You build a proton accelerator, such as we have at Fermilab. the proton is accelerated in a circular device through which it passes over and over, getting a kick each time until it's got a lot of energy, and then it smashes into a target. And like the cosmic rays, it makes garbage. This garbage includes pi mesons. When the pi mesons disintegrate, they make, just like in the cosmic ray case, muons and muon neutrinos.
How do you detect the difference between the kinds of muons, and how do you know that the sun only makes electron muons?
May I get to the second question first? How do we know that the sun makes only electron neutrinos? Well, we know the sun makes only electron neutrinos because we know the sun makes only electrons. So the question really could be, how do we know that? To make a particle like a muon, you have to have enough energy to create the mass of the particle you're making. Einstein taught us that you can convert energy into mass or mass into energy, but to make a particle with a certain mass, you have to have enough energy to convert that energy into that mass. The muon is heavier than the electron, and the nuclear reactions that power the sun don't have enough energy to make muons, and still less do they have enough energy to make taus, which are heavier still. So the only thing they can make is electrons, and the neutrinos that come with electrons are electron neutrinos. Hence, the sun makes only electron neutrinos. Same thing, the nuclear reactions in a nuclear power plant. Those reactions don't have enough energy to make muons or taus, so they make only electrons. And what comes together with electrons? Electron neutrinos. Happens to be antineutrinos, but never mind. Okay?
Regarding the oscillations, you said that the oscillations occur because different parts of the soup travel at different speeds.
I did.
What's that?
I did.
And wouldn't that, though, suggest that there would be a drift in one direction as parts of the soup fall behind, as opposed to the oscillation? Things are catching up from time to time?
I have a confession to make. I was trying to give a kind of an accessible picture of what is a tricky quantum mechanical phenomenon involving phases and complex arithmetic and things like this. And I think the picture is more or less correct, but you can't really picture it as particles, one getting behind the other. There is, as you know, in quantum mechanics, a kind of a duality between a particle and a wave. One and the same object behaves both like a particle and like a wave. So think of the neutrino soup as a wave, and it's got, let's forget about nu1, nu2, and nu3, just nu1 and nu2 are enough to illustrate the idea. This wave has two parts, the nu1 part and the nu2 part, and they travel different speeds. So it's like two waves, but each of them has a size, the wavelength, and they're gradually getting apart like this. So if you look at some point, they have drifted apart, and you take a slice of this picture, and you have a different picture now than you did before they started separating. But they're still overlapping to some degree. That's what's going on. Eventually, if you give the neutrinos enough time, and the neutrinos which have enough time are ones that come from a very distant supernova, for example, in another galaxy, these waves drift to the degree that they don't have any overlap anymore, and then the fast neutrinos get here first, and the slower ones get here later, just like that picture. But before this happens, you have this quantum mechanical wiggle.
Could you comment on the idea that the dark matter in the universe is neutrinos?
Yes, I could. There have been some really revolutionary developments in our picture of the universe in recent years. We used to think, as I said at the beginning, that everything is made of the same stuff we are, electrons, protons, and neutrons. and we now know that is not the case. A part of what the universe is made of is what you referred to, the so-called dark matter. That's, let's say, 30% of the total content by mass of the universe. Now, we know from these various astrophysical and cosmological studies, such as what I referred to, that there's an upper bound on how heavy the neutrinos can be. It was what? It was 5 × 10,000,000 of an electron mass. That is a sufficiently small, that is a sufficiently small upper bound that we know that the neutrinos are making a very, very small contribution to the dark matter. Most of the dark matter is not neutrinos. It is also known not to be electrons, protons, and neutrons. So what is it? That is a very interesting question, to which we don't know the answer. So that's the comment.
It's pretty
dark. Yeah, it's very dark. Is the dark matter neutrinos? No.
Why would you disappear if you walked into a blob of antimatter?
Let's take the electron and the positron as an example. Where is the questioner? Hi. Let's take the electron and the positron as an example. The electron is the particle, the positron is the corresponding antiparticle. Let's suppose an electron and a positron meet. Any particle and its antiparticle have the same mass as each other. But if the particle is electrically charged, as an electron is, the antiparticle has the opposite electric charge. Now, electric charge is one of those things that physicists call conserved. That means the amount of electric charge that you have before anything happens never changes. As whatever happens, happens, the amount of electric charge stays fixed. In the case of an electron meeting a positron, you have equal and opposite amounts of electric charge in the two particles, which adds up to no electric charge total. And when they come together, they can annihilate, leaving nothing but energy, which also has no electric charge. So they carry just those complementary particles that they can wipe one another out. And particles that can do that, do that. When an electron and a positron meet, they do annihilate. And if you were to walk up to somebody who looks just like you, except you have reason to believe he's made of antimatter, don't shake his hand.
You spoke of the muons and the taus disappearing when the detector was on. Is there a detector that can catch those, or do they always disappear?
The question is whether there are detectors that can detect muon neutrinos and tau neutrinos. Yes. The snow detector can detect a neutrino of any flavor, although it cannot tell you what flavor the neutrino had. That is, the neutrino comes into the detector and it causes what we call an event, which is detected by the detector. Actually, in the end, light is emitted by this event, and the detector is surrounded by electric eyes basically that detect this light, and there is a reaction which will be set off by an electron or a muon or a tau neutrino, and the light is detected, but the nature of the light does not tell you which kind of a neutrino initiated the event. But you're counting all of the neutrinos. You can detect them all. And since this gives you the total, and since you have another way of detecting neutrinos which detects only the electron neutrinos, you can make the comparison, and the comparison tells you that there were muon and tau neutrinos.
I know that supernova neutrinos have been detected in 1987, and they're formed right when the star implodes within a very short time. There's also a characteristic light curve. Now, if neutrinos have mass, is there some way of comparing it with the photons we see for a delay and thereby get an idea of their mass?
The question, I'm just going to amplify your question a little bit before answering it. The question is this. When a supernova explodes, it emits a lot of neutrinos, which were detected for one supernova in 1987. It also emits a lot of light. Light, of course, travels at the speed of light. Neutrinos, were they massless, would also travel at the speed of light. The speed of light isn't the speed of light. It's the speed of all massless things, of which light is one of the examples. And neutrinos are not an example. They have a small mass, which means they travel slower than light. So the question is, can we compare the time when the light from a supernova arrives here with the time that the neutrinos from the same supernova arrive here and learn something about the neutrino masses? In principle, the answer is yes, but the sensitivity to mass is such that there are better ways of learning about the neutrino masses. Not much better ways. There actually is information about neutrino mass from supernova 1987A. It limits the mass of the neutrinos to something like 400 times that number that I was quoting for the actual masses. So you see, we're, you know, a few hundred times less sensitive than the best techniques, but we're less sensitive. So in principle, you're absolutely right. You can learn stuff that way, but it's not as sensitive as other ways.
Can you say something about the frequency of oscillation for neutrinos?
The frequency with which the neutrinos do this depends on the splitting between the masses. It depends not on how heavy nu1 is or on how heavy nu2 is, but on the difference between their masses. Actually, the difference between the squares of their masses, but never mind. And from the measured frequencies, these splittings have been learned, but we know only the splittings. You can move the whole mass pattern up or down, and you wouldn't affect the oscillation data. That's why the oscillation data don't tell us how heavy any one individual neutrino is. Now, in terms of frequency, you know, how long does it take a neutrino to do this? Well, it's best expressed in how far does the neutrino go while it does this, traveling at the speed of light, which is roughly what it travels. In the case of the atmospheric neutrinos, the cosmic ray generated neutrinos, for neutrinos of a typical energy, it's about 500 miles. When the neutrino goes 500 miles, it has oscillated one wave from being a pure nu mu to being a pure something else to being a pure nu mu again. And it depends on the energy in a way that actually has nothing to do with neutrinos. It has to do with Mr. Einstein's relativity. And as you increase the energy, the neutrino has to go farther before it does one of these wiggles.
Hi, I'm just trying to understand what is anti about an anti-neutrino. If it has no charge, it can't be like an electron. Is it eliciting? Is that?
Yes, that is a very good question.
Oh, and does the standard model predict annihilation between, if you could live long enough to see a collision?
The positron is different from the electron. We know it's different because they have opposite electric charge. And the question was, well, what's anti about an anti-neutrino? Because a neutrino has no electric charge. So maybe the anti-neutrino is the same as the neutrino? Is that the possibility you're raising?
No.
Almost every theorist I know, including me, has the prejudice that there's nothing anti about an anti-neutrino, and that just as you are suggesting, they are the same particle. But if they're the same particle, how can the behavior of neutrinos and the behavior of antineutrinos be different? And I was talking about them being different. I was trying to avoid this little subtlety because it can be confusing. But since you raised it, and it is very perceptive of you to raise it, let me try to explain this. When you talk about the thing that is called a neutrino, an electron neutrino, for example, you mean the thing that is born together with a positron. What comes out is a positron plus a neutrino. If instead I looked at a reaction that makes an electron plus a, that is it what we call an antineutrino? It's the charge of the electron or the positron that determines what we call the neutrino-like particle. And neutrinos spin like little tops. And it happens that the physics that creates these electrons and these neutrinos creates, together with a positron, a neutrino that spins like this, and together with an electron, a neutrino that spins like that. And it could be that the only difference between the two particles is that one spins this way and the other spins the other way. And if I had a spin bender, I could turn one particle into the other and there's nothing anti about them at all. But it still could be that the behavior of this particle and the behavior of that particle are different. And that's the difference in behavior that I was talking about.
Would it theoretically
result in annihilation if you were to... Yes. The annihilation is possible and has in effect been observed to occur whether there's a difference between neutrino and antineutrino or they're the same particle.
You mentioning the spin one way and the spin the other way of the neutrino and antineutrino. Okay, with the electron, the spin up or spin down is related to the magnetic moment, I believe. Okay, well, all right. A neutrino wouldn't have a magnetic moment because it has no charge. Is that right?
No.
Well, okay.
But it's close.
all right. Well, if it does have a charge, then could you change the spin orientation by adding a little boost of energy or...
I'll try to amplify the question as I've been doing. The electron, in addition to having an electric charge, spins like a little top, as we've said, and as the questioner is saying, it also it behaves like a little bar magnet. And the bar magnet is aligned with the axis around which it is spinning. So one way you can reverse the way it's spinning is by applying a magnetic field or bringing up another magnet which bends this magnet around, taking the spin with it. The question is, does a neutrino have a little bar magnet like an electron does? And you suggested that because it has no charge, maybe it doesn't have a magnetic dipole moment, which means just a little bar magnet. That brings us back to the previous question. If, in fact, there is no difference between a neutrino and an antineutrino, then not only is a neutrino electrically neutral, it's very neutral. It does not have a bar magnet, and you cannot reverse its spin by applying a magnetic field. On the other hand, if it's different from the antineutrino, then it can, and in fact, it is expected in general to have a little bar magnet. And you could, in principle, reverse its spin by bringing up a magnetic field. However, the strength of this bar magnet is very, 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 very feeble. And you would need one hell of a big magnetic field. There was a time, there is still a time right now, when people detecting neutrinos from the sun believe they see a time variation in the number of neutrinos that are coming here still as electron neutrinos. And there had been speculation that what's happening is not that the electron neutrinos are turning into another flavor, but the spin is getting bent around so that the spin is pointing the wrong way for the detector to see the particle. And that would mean that the neutrino has a bar magnet and the sun's magnetic field is bending the spin around. But the sun's magnetic field strength is more or less known, and at least the prejudice of most theorists is that if there is a bar magnet, it is way, way, way too small to be bent around by the sun's magnetic field. But it's a very good question. We don't know. I mean, that's among the questions we have about neutrinos. Do they have little bar magnets? We don't know. If they're the same as their antiparticles, then they can't.
When the neutrino flavors oscillate, is this oscillation in a predictable sequence or is it random?
The frequency with which the oscillation occurs, or how long the neutrino has to travel for one full oscillation to occur, depends, as I mentioned, on the mass splittings. Nobody could have told you in advance how big those mass splittings are. That's something that we've learned from the oscillation experiments. And for example, if the mass splitting that drives the oscillation of the atmospheric neutrinos, the neutrinos that oscillate while they travel the diameter of the Earth, if that mass splitting were much smaller than it actually is, then the neutrinos could transit the whole Earth and they wouldn't have oscillated. Or if it were much bigger than it actually is, they would have oscillated right away even when coming from just overhead, and we would detect no difference between the downward going flux and the upward going flux. No oscillation, they'd be equal. Oscillation from both directions, again they'd be equal. So we're lucky. The mass splitting is such that the size of the Earth is just right, and we were able to see this oscillation. And okay, there was a time when people said, how come the size of the Earth is just right that you can see this oscillation? Isn't that a little too lucky to be true? And then I once saw a wonderful illustration in which somebody said, you know, it's very unlikely for two phenomena that have nothing to do with each other to be of the same size. And while he was saying this, he was superposing two circles, one of which represented the sun and the other of which represented the moon, and the moon just blotted out the sun. And that is in fact the way it is. A total solar eclipse just blots out the sun. And a few years from now, the moon will have moved farther away and that will no longer be true. Sometimes we'll look. No, this isn't random. Exactly what it does is predicted, but as is the nature of quantum mechanics, no one can predict what any given neutrino will do. You can just predict the probabilities of various things. So, for example, the solar neutrinos, we now know, will with one-third, it's not just from the solar data, it's from the atmospheric data, it's from all the data taken together. What we have learned is that with one-third probability, the neutrino will still be a new E when it gets here. With one-third probability, it'll be a new mu. With one-third probability, it'll be a new tau. I can't tell you what any given neutrino will be, but if you look at a million of them, a third of them will be new E and so forth.
You said there was a relationship between the mass and the speed of the particles in a massless object would go at the speed of light. Is there the thing that's always why do these get made? And most things you may just stay on the table. I mean, why do these things get made and then suddenly decide to go off at this particular speed?
If a particle is massless, then it will travel at the speed of light. Why does a particle which weighs nothing travel at the speed of light? Okay, let's talk about a particle which weighs something and then let's turn the mass down slowly. If you have a particle which weighs something, like you, and you give yourself some energy, which means energy of motion. That makes you go faster. Now, you give yourself more energy and you go faster still. What was discovered with relativity is that as you approach the speed of light, the amount of energy that has to be added to you to make you go faster still starts to increase. And as you get closer and closer to the speed of light, the amount of energy that has to be given to you to make you go still faster goes to infinity. I mean, we actually see this in the particle accelerators that we have at a place like Fermilab all the time. We start with protons that aren't moving very fast initially, and they are given more energy and they move faster and more energy and they move faster still until they start to approach the speed of light. And then giving them more and more and more and more energy does not increase their speed very much at all. Nothing can travel faster than the speed of light. As the energy that the proton is carrying on its back gets very large, as it's approaching the speed of light, its mass relative to its energy is a very small number. You remember that Einstein taught us that energy and mass are interchangeable, so I can compare them. The mass of the proton is now a very, very tiny fraction of its energy, and it is traveling very close to the speed of light. So now just take the limit of that. As the energy goes to infinity, or equivalently, the mass goes to zero, and you've reached the speed of light. And that's the speed at which a photon, the particle of light, travels. It has no mass, and therefore, it travels at the speed of light.
So it almost seems like speed is really a ratio of the mass to energy.
It is.
That's what speed is.
That's a fine way of looking at it.
You said you detected the neutrinos coming from a supernova, so I wanted to know how you can know where the neutrinos come from when you detect them.
Yeah. How do you know where the neutrinos came from when you detect them? It depends. First of all, one of the detection reactions that I wasn't talking about, but it's an important one, is where the neutrino, this is where the neutrino strikes an electron in the detector. Now, the neutrino may have a very large energy compared to the mass of the electron. So it's like a baseball slugger hitting a pea, wham! And the pea goes off in the direction in which it was struck. So if the neutrino comes from the sun and it hits an electron in the detector, it pushes the electron dead forward. So now you just extrapolate back. From which direction was this object that struck this electron coming? And you discover that looking straight back, you are pointing right at the sun. And in fact, one of the pictures that the people who do these experiments like to show is a picture of the sun in the sky, or it doesn't have to be in the sky, it can be on the other side of the Earth and the neutrinos are coming right straight through, as seen by neutrinos. And you can see, yeah, there's the sun. Let's see, where is the sun now? It's there. So if we had a somewhere like there, below the horizon. So if we had a neutrino detector and we detected the solar neutrinos by this collision with electrons, we'd be able to tell which way the sun is because the electrons would be going in the opposite direction. That's one way. Now, for the supernova, most of the reactions that were used to detect the supernova neutrinos were not reactions on electrons. The way it was known that these were coming from the supernova is somebody saw, I think it was this way historically, somebody saw the supernova in the sky, you know, bright, suddenly brightened star. Hello, neutrino guys? You should be seeing a lot of neutrinos. So they looked at their neutrino data as a function of time, and, you know, so many neutrinos, so many neutrinos, so many neutrinos, whoop! So many neutrinos, so many neutrinos. These extra neutrinos were attributed to the supernova because of their coincidence in time with when you would have expected them from the photons. And interestingly enough, our picture of how a supernova explosion occurs says that a certain known energy should be released, and most of that energy should be carried not by the light, but on the backs of the neutrinos. So if you know how far away the supernova was, you should be able to predict how much energy is deposited by neutrinos in your detector. And these detectors detected the expected amount of neutrinos. I think this was actually one of the major discoveries in recent years, to actually see that, yes, supernovas are what we think they are. There is a certain kind of explosion, and a certain amount of energy is in fact released, and it is carried by neutrinos. We've actually detected those neutrinos. We detected the right number of neutrinos and with the right energy.
Okay. I would like to compliment both Boris for a superb pedagogical lecture and our audience. I must say I'm extraordinarily proud of the KITP audiences for the level of questioning, which was great, and for Boris for handling it. And let's thank him again for a wonderful talk, and please join us for refreshments.